All right, my friends, thanks for tuning into the podcast, where, as always, we'll discuss the professional literature and the evidence-based protocol as they relate to the effective treatment of clinically significant anxiety symptoms. I'm Chris Lines, licensed psychotherapist and OCD spectrum disorders treatment specialist, and this, well, this is OCD Straight Talk. This podcast is made possible by NoCD. NoCD offers effective, affordable, and convenient OCD therapy. NoCD therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention, or ERP therapy, the gold standard treatment for OCD. With NoCD, you can do virtual, live face-to-face video sessions with one of their licensed, specialty-trained therapists, and they accept most major insurance plans. To find out more about NoCD, visit nocd.com. That's nocd.com to book a free 15-minute call. For people in the state of Kentucky, you can go to kentuckyocd.com. That's kentuckyocd.com and book a session with me. But he would come into session and he would talk about these like parties that he was going to and that he had been snorting coke all weekend or whatever it was. And he just didn't have time, you know, for the homework. He just didn't have time to fill out the ritual monitoring sheets or, you know, or whatever it was. And I remember this sort of feeling in the room that I was the one in the hot seat. I was the one that was being paid to get him better. The onus of responsibility was on me, not on him. And I was naive and immature enough in my professional journey that I bought into that, right? And that I sort of played along with the narrative that I was responsible for the outcome of the therapeutic process, and he wasn't. I'm the professional in the room, and he's paying for services, so I had better deliver. And so week after week, session after session, I would kind of excuse the behavior that he had blown off the homework again and that he hadn't bothered with the ritual monitoring sheets, regardless of the fact that he had been asked about them over and over and over. And I would just sort of say, well, you know what? That's okay. That's all right. Don't worry about it. Right? And maybe I wouldn't use those exact words, but that was the message conveyed. That's okay. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Well, if you know much about the professional literature and the outcome data, it's not going to be a surprise to you that eventually this patient washed out of treatment and didn't get better. At least as far as I know, he didn't get better. And that was a hard moment for me. It was humbling and it was embarrassing. I was so sad to see him go. I was so disappointed in myself that I wasn't able to get him better. And that was the beginning for me of the realization of learning that when it comes to treating somebody with OCD, I'm not the one in the hot seat. I'm not the one who's responsible for making specific and targeted behavior changes. That's not me, because I don't have the ability to make those changes. You know what I'm saying? The onus of responsibility falls on the patient, him or herself, right? And like I say, that was the beginning of really realizing that I'm not the one on the hot seat. But more than that, I'm doing the patient a marvelous disservice, a tremendous disservice when I don't call him on his irresponsible behaviors, when I don't inform him that the outcome data is based upon a specific process. If I want to arrive at a specific destination, I have to follow the prescribed steps, so to speak, to get there. If I don't make the right turns and I don't follow the correct roads for the right amount of distance, the likelihood that I'm going to magically arrive at the destination is dramatically decreased. And the same concept applies here, that if we're working to arrive at a specific symptomatologic destination, the research would suggest, we have to follow the correct steps. And so my job becomes working to inform the patient what his responsibility is in the therapeutic journey within this specific interchange called therapy. right? My job is to equip him with skills, but even more than that, I might argue, my job is to make sure he understands the parameters in which he needs to travel, and that the onus of responsibility to make those specific targeted changes is on him, not on me. And this is one of the reasons you have heard me say, my job is not to treat your anxiety disorder. My job is not to treat your OCD system. That's not my job. And the reason that's not my job but yours is because I can't create the behavior changes in you necessary for symptom reduction to happen. That's something that only you can do. And it was out of this experience, it was out of this journey, if you will, that the five pillars was formed, that I began really looking for the answer to the question, what do patients have to do to get better? And I began noticing that some patients don't really get better, and other patients do. And of course, behind that observation is the question, why? Why is it that some patients respond well to exposure and response prevention and other patients don't? That's another way of asking the question, why is it that only some patients get better in what is proven to be an evidence-based process? Why? And it was out of this experience and this observation that the five pillars was born. This idea that, okay, my job is to teach and to articulate. My job is to help the patient understand what is expected of him or her in the process of getting better. And what the five pillars document does, well, it doesn't just answer that question, but what it works to show is, like, the more we cut corners and deviate from this specific process, the less likely we're actually going to make progress. So patients are informed from the beginning that, okay, I have a specific role in the process. And I think that in some real way, the five pillars sort of parallels the idea of the Y-Box cheat sheet. And essentially, the Y-Box cheat sheet is this kind of concept that says, well, since the Y-Box, the Yale-Brown Obsessive Compulsive Scale, and by the way, this is Y-Box 2, since it's a validated psychometric, and we know that it is, in fact, measuring something real, since it's validated, you can't actually really cheat the test. So the idea of the cheat sheet says, how do I get the best possible score as quickly as I can? Knowing that a good score, as opposed to a bad score, if you will, is parallel to decreased symptom severity. So a smaller number on Y-Box 2 would indicate symptoms that are no longer as severe as they were, right? And the Y-Box cheat sheet says, how do I get there as fast as I can? Well, let me tell you. And so the idea is everything hinges on question number six. And question number six, of course, is how much time are you doing compulsions? Now, the one assumption that seems to be being made by Y-Box 2 is that you, the taker of the test, know all of your compulsions. Hence, how much time are you doing these? The problem is many OCDers are only in the process of discovering their compulsions. And when they first take the test at the very beginning of treatment, they're very much at only the beginning of that discovery process. So you follow what I'm saying? In other words, most patients that are taking the test for the first time really have very little idea as to what their compulsions are. And so when the question comes, how much time are you doing compulsions? You know, they're very much flying blind, if you will, at least in my opinion. Nevertheless, theoretically, the idea is, how much time are you doing compulsions? And the reality is, the smaller the number, 0 to 5, the smaller the number, the less time you're reporting you're doing compulsions, which is a very good thing. But also what that indicates is questions 7, 8, and 10 are necessarily smaller as well. You could say it the other way too. The higher your answer to question number 6, the higher your answers are going to be to questions 7, 8, and 10. And correspondingly, the more time you're doing compulsions, in all likelihood, the more intrusive thoughts you're gonna have and the more anxiety those thoughts are gonna produce, which is questions 1 through 5. Hence, you see everything hinges on 6, and the more you can drive down your answer to question number 6, the more your OCD system in general is gonna unravel and fall apart, and the lower and lower your score on the Y-box is going to be. right? So it really does matter to identify the compulsions. But the point is that the Y Box cheat sheet parallels the idea of the five pillars. The five pillars is the answer to the question, what's my role in making progress? How do I get better as fast as I can? And the answer to that most profoundly is pillar number five, which is always, always stop compulsions. And everything that builds up to pillar five, that is to say pillars one through four, are really sort of like support pieces to pillar five. And further, I think what you could say, theoretically, is if you disregard pillars one through four, but you really put the screws to pillar five, and you, in a disciplined capacity, really put the effort in over time to stopping these compulsions, again, pillar five, the research is going to strongly suggest, in all likelihood, you're going to get better, even though you disregarded 80% of the five pillars. And of course, the five pillars are based upon the literature itself, right? So it's like, so you begin to see the importance, and this is something to which Abramowitz and Jacoby bore witness in 2014 in a study on the efficacy of exposure and response prevention without stopping compulsions. So they showed that exposure therapy without ritual prevention is actually quite ineffective. So you see that in the five pillars, everything is building ultimately to stop compulsions. Whether we're talking about going to therapy consistently and doing exposure therapy, which is pillar one, or we're talking about doing homework consistently on a daily basis, which is pillar two, or we're talking about accepting uncertainty and embracing that which we don't and cannot know relative to our intrusive thoughts, pillar three, or if we're talking about the daily completion of ritual monitoring sheets, that is to say the ongoing search for compulsions, that's pillar four, all of this really serves in some way as the staging area, right? This is sort of like, this is where we're building up, we're preparing, we're getting ourselves organized to execute the mission. And the execution of the mission essentially is stop the compulsions. It's not just find the therapist and do the exposure work and make sure you're doing it consistently and conceptualize uncertainty appropriately and search for the compulsions and all that stuff. Of course, again, all these pieces are very, very important. Please don't get it twisted. They're very important. And the only reason I really say it this way is because I'm one of those people that I like to understand the essence of something and then work to conceptualize the other pieces within the context of the big idea or the essence. And the essence here is stop compulsions. That's true on the Y Box 2. That's true on the Y Box cheat sheet. That's true in your conceptualization of exposure and response prevention. That's true overall in beating the OCD system. The essence of the mission is stop the compulsions. Everything else that we're including in terms of conceptual matters that you need to understand and that you need to be disciplined in incorporating into your process, all of these really revolve around and build up to the mission, which is force the behaviors into submission. It's stop the compulsions. So we'll get into all this, and I'm hoping that you'll tune in for each episode ready and working to conceptualize your role in the process of getting better. Well, that's it for another episode of OCD Straight Talk. Feel free to reach out with any questions you might have to chrislines04@gmail.com. If you found the podcast helpful, consider giving it a 5-star rating or subscribing to OCD Straight Talk for structured help with your anxiety or OCD symptoms.